Hello, and welcome to the Sound of Economics podcast from Bruegel, the economic policy think tank based in Brussels. My name is Sean Gibson, and I'm here today to present another edition of our Deep Focus series, where we talk to Bruegel scholars about the key findings in their research papers. For this one, I'm joined by Bruegel fellow Marek Dabrowski. Hello, Marek.
Hello.
We'll be looking through some of Marek's work on the Russian economy today, specifically its performance in the last half decade or so, which was covered in a Bruegel policy contribution that Marek has co-written with Antoine Mathieu Collin. So, Marek, Russia has emerged from a crisis period, which you detail as between 2014 and 2016.
Correct.
Your paper looks at previous crises as well in the Russian economy. You've noted this time that the post-crisis growth is more sluggish. Could you expand a little on this for us, detail the problem a little more specifically?
Yes, indeed. As compared to very well-known 1998-1999 currency and debt crisis and banking crisis, as compared to 2008-2009 crisis, which was some spillover of the global financial crisis. In both cases, there was a deep recession immediately, but then quite fast recovery. This time, recession was not so deep. Cumulatively, Russian economy lost about 2% in 2015-16. But the recovery is also, as you mentioned, very sluggish. And I would say that this is in spite of some similarities between all three crises episode, actually circumstances they happen and underlying characteristic of the Russian economy is pretty different than it was 1998, for example, 2008. And this is general answer to your question.
So, yeah, I guess this leads us into the more specific points that your paper details as underlying causes for this this slow return to growth in the Russian economy. We could start perhaps with the point you make about Russia's macroeconomic management following the and perhaps during the 2014-16 crisis. What specific problems do you see here?
I don't see too many problems. Basically, by comparing to the previous periods, which we already mentioned, 1998-1999 and 2008-2009, and also as compared to some other emerging market crises, for example, recent experience of 2018 or Argentina or Turkey, I would say that macroeconomic management was generally prudent and consequent. And this also, I think, is one of the factors which limited output losses this time. There can be some critical comments regarding the very initial period of the crisis, I mean autumn 2014. And I would mention here two specific issues. One was the using central bank reserves and monetary policy to rescue some large state-owned banks and corporations hit by both the consequences of the declining oil prices and devaluation, also consequences of the sanction related to Ukrainian conflict, which we probably will speak a bit later more detailly. And the second was the decision of central bank to introduce a new monetary policy strategy, inflation targeting, in November 2014, exactly in the midst of the crisis, which decisions itself I consider that it's the right decision, but it should happen much earlier, and the timing of introducing this decision was not optimal, and this led to some sort, these both factors of market panic in mid of December 2014. But looking back with the benefit of hindsight, I would say that these were not so fundamental problems. Once again, macroeconomic management, especially fiscal management, I think was really prudent, and I would say that this is the main reason why output losses were relatively limited this time, unlike 2008, for example, where were much, much larger.
Yes. You did mention in your answer there about Ukraine, and obviously it's hardly a secret that the Russian involvement in Ukraine in 2014 had significant economic repercussions. But could you provide a bit more detail as to how this actually played out specifically?
Well, let me start from some general reflections that in contemporary, very interconnected world, any kind of, I would say, adventurous foreign policy, especially with in situation when you challenge the existing multilateral order, global and European order, as well, was done by Russia in case of annexation of Crimea, and also in case of supporting rebellion in Donbass, is not favorable to trade, is not favorable to economic development. In this particular case, Western partners of Russia, mainly United States and European Union, but also backed by some other countries like Norway, like Japan, Canada, most of EU candidates country, introduced sanctions, which could be disaggregated into few categories. Some of them had political and diplomatic character, like suspending G8, returning to G7 format, like suspending negotiation on Russia accession to OECD, suspending political dialogue within existing EU-Russia partnership and cooperation agreements, suspending visa liberalization negotiation, etc., etc. Second category, these were targeted personal sanction, mostly visa bans and asset freezing against people who were considered instrumental in taking a decision against Ukraine. The third one, and I think most important from the point of view which we analyze here, there were various kind of trade and financial sanctions, which again could be divided into two subcategories. One of them was export and import bans on weaponry, on some dual use equipment, etc., some technologies, for example, technologies for exploration of oil and gas fields, etc. Another one were limits on financing, refinancing some state-owned banks, state-owned companies like, for example, Gazprom or Rosneft, and some other limits on financial operation. And from analytical perspective, this one were the most painful in the initial period of the crisis. I mean, end of 2014 and 2015, and they probably magnified effect of declining oil prices. So other things being equal, without sanction, probably devaluation of the Russian ruble will be less smaller, and also shock imposed by this devaluation to the Russian financial system, to corporate finance, especially of those large corporations which were heavily exposed to borrowing abroad, would be smaller. This also would eliminate necessity of these extra interventions in the end of 2014 of Central Bank of Russia, which I already mentioned. Now, when we think about impact, here is not so easy to single out effects. If we look in various analytical works, most of them were done in 2015, 2016, so relatively in the relatively early stage of functioning of this sanction, they tend to estimate the annual effect between 1 and 2% of percentage point of lost GDP, which I am not sure that this is correct estimation. Perhaps they are overestimated. But nevertheless, I think that they are much more painful in longer term perspective. And this is one of the reasons why post-crisis recovery is so sluggish, because they indirectly, they discourage foreign investment in Russia. They encourage capital flight. If we look for the balance of payment, 2014, especially in last quarter, recorded the largest ever in post-Soviet Russian history, capital flight from Russia. I would link this to the effect of sanction, and this effect, if we take into account that sanction story is not finished, especially on US side, that they are new sanction which were introduced in 2018, is ongoing discussion about new wave of sanction which may hit, for example, Russian public debt instruments. They have negative impact on capital movement, both of Russian and non-Russian origin. They have negative impact on investment. They have negative impact on technology, of technology import, on cooperation between Russia and its main Western partners. So this is looking ahead, this is also one of the barriers to potentially higher growth.
Your study, in addition to the factors we've already discussed, it looks at certain structural characteristics and also what you call institutional shortcomings within the Russian economy that could also have contributed to this poor return to growth post-crisis. So if you could elaborate on what some of these structural characteristics and institutional shortcomings are, then I think that could be something that's quite key to the research.
Let's start me from the second meaning, institutional characteristic, because this is a problem which didn't appear just recently. This is the legacy of the Soviet system, this is a problem which Russian economy, not only Russian economy, practically all economies of the former Soviet Union are struggling with for quite a long time. Here, of course, the picture is not so clear-cut because, for example, according to the World Bank Doing Business annual survey, Russia in a few recent years recorded some progress in simplifying registration procedures, in cutting cost of some administrative procedures, etc. But and this is true, especially in large centers like Moscow, like St. Petersburg, like Novosibirsk, Yekaterinburg, Nizhny Novgorod. Administrative condition to start and run business improved in some respects. But on the other hand, what is not well captured by this particular survey and is only partly captured by some others, like, for example, Heritage Foundation Index of Economic Freedom, safety of property rights, which was always a problem in post-communist Russia. Or some historian tell that this was a problem even before Bolshevik Revolution in Tsarist Russia, but will not go so far back. It deteriorated. It deteriorated, meaning that, of course, international public opinion is familiar with some spectacular cases, like, for example, taken over of Yukos in 2005, and then Bashkar Neft and Neft and some other things. But this works on not only on in respect to the largest companies, but also. Also medium-sized companies. The characteristic of Russian post-Soviet state apparatus is very predatory. And this, again, concerns not only obvious, I would say, suspects like tax administration, etc., but also and maybe in first instance, law enforcement agencies, police, security services, intelligence, prosecutor offices. They all want to extract rents from business. And cases of politically motivated expropriation or expropriations motivated by some, I would say, criminal interest or semi-criminal interest are really very frequent. And this is a question which probably cannot be solved by improving administrative procedures related to economic activity in business. This requires much broader institutional and political reform, like having, for example, really, truly independent judicial branch of government and professional enough. And this is a big problem. This is a big problem. And frankly speaking, without political changes, I don't think that this can happen soon. So these are real I would say what Russian economists and Russian businessmen call state racketeering. It's probably one of the biggest problems. And now when we add the change in political atmosphere since Crimea adventures, that one of the consequences of confrontation with the West and sanction and counter-sanction, which I didn't mention because in response to Western sanction, Russian government imposed ban on food import from countries which introduced sanction against Russia. So basically all this some way contributed to reverse of the, I would say, traditional, some sense, or historical, sometimes hysteric atmosphere on confrontation with United States, with Europe, searching for spies, etc., etc. So this additionally deteriorated atmosphere, not only of foreign enterprise, foreign investors, but also of Russian investors. This also pushed for import substitution policy, which was relatively costly, but gave very little. And, okay, so this is my answer regarding institutional characteristics.
Yes.
Regarding structural, it's well known that Russia economy is very much dominated by hydrocarbon production, oil and gas, in terms of dependence on budget revenue, in terms of balance of payments, in terms of the share of hydrocarbons in export and its share in GDP. My attitude to this is perhaps a bit different than many other economies, especially Russian one, which consider this as a curse, which without solving it is impossible to do anything. I would say that it's a natural specialization, given geographic characteristic of Russia. I cannot imagine this economy not being substantial producer and exporters of raw materials, of energy, etc. But this, of course, has caused via so-called Dutch disease effect. So, especially when oil and gas prices are high, rents obtained from this source are high, they push exchange rate, real exchange rate, appreciating. And this, of course, make export of other goods, especially manufacturing goods, less convenient and increases attractiveness of import. So when we go back to what happened in 2014, a deep devaluation of Russian ruble, this opens some space for structural transformation, because oil and gas related trends went down. Ruble depreciated both in nominal and real terms, so it made a substantial part of import unattractive, and it increased, I would say, naturally, improved condition for exporting. And I would something like this happened, by the way, after 1998-1999 crisis, and then response overcoming transition-related recession of 1990s. One of the characteristics was very strong recovery of manufacturing industry and partly agriculture. This time, agriculture benefited largely, I would say, from import ban on the Western food. Regarding manufacturing industry, there is no clear evidence. There were some structural shifts. I would risk saying that that deteriorating business climate, which we spoke about, and sanctions, capital outflow, etc., they didn't allow this kind of effect, positive restructuring effect, to happen this time.
And I think we should also mention, as your paper does, the factor that demographic trends play in Russia. in with regard to growth as well. Now, Russia is hardly the only country grappling with unfavorable demographics, but in this case, what have you assessed to be the nature of the problem they're facing with regard to demographics?
Well, the nature is the same as the one which we observe entire Europe. Russia is a European country. Of course, there are some small differences. For example, countries like UK or France, they recorded higher fertility rate than many others, including most of countries of Central Eastern Europe and former Soviet Union, including Russia. This is, I would say, so-called second demographic transition observed in most of advanced economy and many middle-income economies. Also, this, one of the first countries which happened was Japan. Now China is also entering in very drastic form as a result of administrative regulation of birth rate in the previous few decades. And there are, I would say, two things which are worth to mention in this context. First is to remember about this factor when we do economic analysis. And this relates not only to Russia, this relates also to all debates on European sluggish growth and for example, about several lost decades in Japan. This is neoclassical growth theory, which thinks labor as one of the key growth factor apart from capital and total factor productivity growth. And of course, when population is growing, working age population is growing by 1 or 2% annual, as it was the situation of most European countries and also Soviet Union in the post-Second War period, is one thing. When your working age population declines, it's completely different situation. And so what something was, you know, seen 1 or 2% growth as very, very disappointing in economy in which population grows rapidly, for example, India or most African country, is not so disappointing in country where population shrink. So this is one just very general analytical reflection. The second is how the individual countries can deal with this problem. Basically, there are two avenues. One is migration, incoming migration. Second one is increasing labor market engagement of the existing population. What concerns the first measure, Russia, formally and informally, here is a big debate how it's done, but it's relatively open to incoming migration, especially from countries of the former Soviet Union, which have still labor force surpluses. I mean, especially countries of post-Soviet Central Asia, like Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, but also European post-Soviet countries like Armenia, like Moldova, to a lesser extent, Azerbaijan and Georgia and Ukraine. So here, I, at least from macro point of view, I think Russia policy is right, and we can complain about specific administrative procedures and treatment of migrants by police, by public administration, but this is a separate story. Regarding activization of the domestic labor force, long time was not, nothing was done. Russia had one of the lowest retirement age, with many additional privileges exception. Last year, it must be given credit to government, also to president. They invested their political capital into conducting a quite far-going reform, basically on average increasing retirement age of both men and women by 5 years in the 10 years period. So this is right movement. It should improve labor market situation. So I would say that in terms of responses, policy is generally correct.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground with you today, but taking all of these assessments into account, what going forward then is are the most necessary measures to restore and revive growth in the Russian economy, and where is it realistic to expect the Russian economy to be in 5 to 10 years' time?
It's much easier to respond me to first part of your question. From the review which we did, it's quite obvious that the main problem is unfavorable business and investment climate. Both, I would say, it's internal and international dimension. Internal meaning to improve rule of law, to conduct reforms of judiciary, of public administration, strengthening civil rights, etc. Whether it can be is realistic within the existing political regime without touching some basic characteristics of political system, I doubt. Some incremental improvement is possible, simplifying administrative procedure, which I already mentioned. But this is there are minor changes. The biggest problem, making property rights more secure, I doubt that can be solved within only, I would say, narrow economic or legal agenda. It requires also political reform. Second part, I would say, international, meaning that abandoning confrontation policy vis-a-vis major economic partners. Major economic partners of Russia, there is European Union. This is major in terms of trade, in terms of investment. But also United States, which share in Russian export-import is not so big. Is important partner as the source of investment, as source of new technologies. Here, this is absolutely critical issue for the future development of any countries, including Russia. So basically, foreign security policy of this country must be bring in line with requirement of globalization, international economic cooperation. Whether it happens and when, this is beyond my competences. I am not political forecaster, and history demonstrates that forecasting political changes, reforms, it's very risky business, because these are non-linear processes. They sometimes can be triggered by some unexpected events. So for the moment, I would say that probably continuation of the current trend of relatively slow growth, responsive fiscal monetary policy, and perhaps some incremental changes, both in positive and negative direction in institutional sphere, are most likely scenario.
Well, I think that about brings us to the end of this this deep focus episode. Thank you, Marek, for joining me, and thank you to everyone for listening and joining us. This podcast is just one of many that we have available at our website, along with all of our other blog posts and publications, the website being www.bruegel.org. I hope you can join us again for The Sound of Economics. Until next time, ta-ra.